meeting. But henceforth, the chair of the Standing Committee on Finance will in fact take responsibility from next year. So to explain the procedure very quickly to the new members and civil society who is here, what we do is we first hear from National Treasury. You reply to all the submissions received from civil society. And then we give civil society a chance to come back. Then you reply to them, and then we open up a discussion. So we have a full discussion, having heard both sides, rather than, you know, a scattered one. Secondly, as you know, especially for those of you flying, for those of us, let's say, flying to airports outside Etegwini, Johannesburg, we take two flights, and there are a very limited number of flights. So we seek to finish, usually, about 11:30 or so, because people have got their flights, they've got to get to the airport. And unfortunately, if you're not staying in Etegwini or Joburg, you have to leave around that time. So having said that, is that agreed, the procedure? Good, okay. So you've got half an hour, then we give 15 minutes to civil society, then you have another 15 minutes, and then we throw it open. Good, thank you very much. And can the researchers please note you have to meet the chairs? Can we just deal quickly with the process we've had for the last five-year period? All parties agreed to this, and the chairperson of the standing committee has also been briefed, and he broadly agreed. What we do is the chairs get the report around Sunday evening, and the recommendations obviously we have to manage based on advice we get from the staff, but then we send it out to all parties by 14:00 on the Monday. And then we go through it section by section on the Tuesday in a joint committee meeting. Usually what we've done, and it's been agreed to, but you know there's a new era, we look mostly at the recommendations. The overview is basically the key points that each of the stakeholders have submitted. And the stakeholders who are here, if you can submit, let's say, a page of your main points, we will cover it as it is. So I don't know if the staff have done that. Normally we write to, Alan should know this, Nkululeko is new, you know, to write to them and say, can you give us a half a page summary? Has that been done, or a page? It isn't already. Okay, fine. So we don't try to interpret what the stakeholders say more than they interpret what they, that's what they say. Let them summarize their submission as far as possible, because they want to be heard as best as possible. Where we come in the recommendation section. And Comrade Chair, what we have done is we've said having long reports, 40-page reports, 60-page reports that lead to no practical outcomes, that's not worth it, really. What we have said is that the overview should be 8-10 pages maximum. And it must include those who didn't appear for oral hearings, those who have given written submissions. Their submissions are just as valid as those who did oral submissions, right? So they have to be covered. We should, at least a third of the report, at least 5 to 6 pages, should be on observations and recommendations. And that's the section the committee focuses on Tuesday. So we can finish on Tuesday within 2 hours normally. What we have also said is if people have difficulties with sections of the report, recommendations, they can send to us Monday night in writing some of their changes. The final point, Comrade Chair, is would the changes, Frank, guide us? You can see from the way the old order people spoke, is that there's no point having two separate reports. And can we move and second that we do one report where we put the revised fiscal framework for this financial year recommendations and then the recommendations for the proposed fiscal framework? So we deal with both separately but in the same report. Frank, is that doable, right, in terms of the law we amended?
Sure, yes, that is doable. The report must just indicate clearly whether the revised fiscal framework is adopted or not.
Yeah.
Because that's a requirement we have to adopt to get the other bills into the stream, into the value chain.
And then do we require a formal resolution here that we have one report but deal with the recommendation separately? Or is it a choice that is doable and therefore we don't need to move and second it?
Chair, I think if we the committee adopts the report as it's allowed, and then that stands for itself.
Okay. Then the question that arises, colleagues, is do we now have two debates? We still have to have two debates, or what happens? I was thinking about it only now when I'm driving. I didn't think of sharing that with the chair. I have looked, to be fair to the chair, it's a difficult process. It's an original process. We don't need to have this meeting. This was adopted in February 2015, we decided to have this session. It was never done before to encourage dialogue. So we don't have to do this, but it's a correct way to go, and the chair agrees. The question then is, we used to have two debates. Nobody observed the debates. And the chairperson of the House or the Speaker never intervened and said, you know, I raise this thing with the powers that be in Parliament. Why does the Speaker or the House Chair allow that? Why didn't you say, excuse me, member, you are talking about the fiscal framework that you're going to have a debate in 3 weeks' time. Focus on the revenue. Nobody comes here. You know, nobody came here and said, our proposals on the revised fiscal framework are the following, and our proposals on the three-year fiscal framework to come are the following. It doesn't happen. It's too sophisticated a model. It may work in the advanced industrialized countries, in established democracies, even for them. But it doesn't work in an emerging democracy, really. But people wanted it, so there it is. Do we have to have two debates?
No, I think if there's one report, it'll go through as one debate, but it's something that the NA and NCOP table staff will be more in a better position to advise.
So will you engage on behalf of this committee and do it?
Sure.
That's all for it. So we agree on one report. So can we plead with the drafters, we'll meet with you for 5 minutes after the meeting, that you put in recommendations on revised fiscal framework for this financial year, recommendations on the proposed fiscal framework for the MTF period. Okay? Done. Good. And then at the end of the meeting, what we normally do, the chairs take some responsibility for proposing to the staff what are some recommendations that must go in. And you are free to comment as well. Okay, the last 5 minutes we do that, 10 minutes. This is a procedure. But remember, the new chairperson and the new committee on the standing committee side will take its own decisions. This is just the old process. It's for you to decide. And we deal mostly with the provinces from the NCOP side. So our concern in the report is not to duplicate what you're doing. Our concern in the report, can I plead with colleagues, is to look at what is of our interest, which is provincial. And to be quite frank, Comrade Chair, the last point I'd like to make, especially for the NCOP members, strictly speaking, although we are co-equals, on this report, strictly speaking, the more I think about it, Comrade Chair, NCOP doesn't really have a very prominent role here. We have a far more important role on the division of revenue and the appropriations bill, because that deals with the spheres of government. Here we are dealing with, what are we dealing with? Economic forecast for the country as a whole, not for provinces. Inflation, debt to GDP ratio, budget surplus. That's one country as a whole. Strictly speaking, it's the NA that must lead on this. On the division of revenue and so on, strictly speaking, it's the NCOP that must lead on that. But we duplicate too much, but that's another story we have to deal with. Frank, you need to think as a lawyer. I mean, I'm there now for how many months? 6 months. We duplicate too much on that side. I think Mr. Ryder agrees partly with me. But the reason is, no, he doesn't agree, that's fine. But they have a different view. They border on seeing us as a federal state. So they take it to the extremes. I'm talking from the national democratic perspective. Let's not confuse Mr. Ryder and me, right? We feel that, for other reasons than the DA would, that the NCOP should focus more on provincial issues, really. So we have a division of labor. But you think about all of those things, colleagues, because we are amending the Money Bills Act in this sixth term of Parliament also. The first stage was done last year, Comrade Chair, and it will be led by the NA. Thank you very much. It's taken long, but I need to explain because they're new members. Right, it's now 9:14 according to my watch, or 9:15. You've got 30 minutes, right? Good, let's get going. And we try to finish by 11:30, latest quarter to 12. Thank you.
Okay,
thank you.
Here
we go.
Thank you, Chair. And thank you for the opportunity. And I will also explain a little bit about the process, because this is a new committee. My name is Ian Stewart. I'm the acting
chair. One more procedure on that we have to deal with. Sorry. Alan said he distributed a letter to you about Helen Suzman Foundation. Yeah, we'll consider that, remember? It's really a legal matter. It's between the lawyers here and the lawyers there. It's nothing to do with us. It's to do with the minister. The minister must answer for what he said. We abide by the law. Thank you.
Okay. So, first of all, just to say that I think it was the longest list of submissions we've had yet, and the process seems to be gaining momentum every year. So thank you very much. We've gone through the submissions in great detail. You can see the list here. It's an extremely wide-ranging group of organizations, and some of these proposals were very detailed indeed. And as I say, we've gone through all of them in great detail, and we have pulled together what we believe are the three major areas of discussion. We cannot cover everything comprehensively, but we obviously will do our best, and if there are follow-up questions, we'll try to answer those as well. But in broad terms, there were effectively three areas that came up repeatedly, and that was to do, first of all, with the growth and revenue forecasts, particularly around the causes of the very large revisions that took place. And then also a discussion on, again, the credibility of the medium-term growth numbers and the revenue forecast, and we're going to try to cover quite a lot of ground there. Then the second major area of discussion was around the topic of fiscal sustainability, and a lot of the debates were around whether this is austerity or not, whether the government needs more austerity or whether it requires stimulus. And we're going to touch on some of that and give our views as well. And then there was also a discussion about targets versus rules, and quite a few of the written submissions spoke of very specific targets, like, for example, a debt-to-GDP ratio of 70%. And we'll touch on that a bit as well. And then there were what we call general budget matters that came up. Some of the concerns were around our infrastructure spending, which we do think is a big area of concern, the underspending on infrastructure. There were questions on the financial support for ESCOM and other state-owned companies, which we'll clarify. Quite a few questions around how we could improve efficiency and reduce waste, wasteful expenditure, and then there was also quite a large representation on tobacco taxes, and we will talk about that. So let me introduce the MTBPS again briefly, and then we will run through the other slides more quickly. So if you have to ask why were the numbers revised so much, there really are three elements that I would point to. The first is around nominal GDP. The nominal GDP numbers changed substantially. And nominal GDP matters a lot for our fiscal ratios, because obviously our debt and our deficits are usually portrayed as a ratio to GDP. So if nominal GDP is coming down, in other words, if the size of your economy is smaller than you anticipated, then even without any fiscal measures, your debt and your deficits will be larger. And that's effectively what happened. So the first thing is that there was a statistical revision to nominal GDP undertaken by Stats SA, which resulted in the size of the economy being revised down quite substantially. In the current year, nominal GDP, the size of the South African economy, is about 200 billion rand lower than what we had in the February budget. In addition to that, we had a substantial downward revision to CPI inflation and GDP inflation. And lastly, we had a contraction in the real economy in the first quarter and a fairly weak improvement in economic growth after that. So if you think of those three elements, a revision, statistical revision, much lower nominal GDP because of inflation and real GDP growth coming down, then you get a much smaller long-term projection of the size of the economy, and that's a big part of the story here. And you can see how that has fed through to the tax revenue numbers. So although the market, I think, and bondholders were anticipating that there was going to be a much wider deficit in the current year, in general, I think there was an assumption that the deficit would be smaller over the medium term. But a big reason as to why the deficit is not narrowing is because our tax revenue numbers have been revised down a lot. And we will go into a little bit of detail there as well. And the last is that we had spending pressures, which emerged after the February budget. The biggest one there, of course, by a large margin, is the additional financial support to ESCOM. The other smaller state-owned companies did also receive some additional support, but that was mostly in the current financial year from the contingency reserve. And then we reversed estimated savings from compensation measures, including early retirement. So those, I think, are the three sort of biggest drivers of the worsening in the fiscal metrics. So in response to this, we as government have proposed that we need to claw back some of the slippage. We've proposed reductions on mostly on goods and services and transfers of around 49.5 billion over the next 2 years, and that non-interest expenditure grow basically in line with CPI inflation in the outer year. So fairly constrained budgets in the outer year as well. But as we say in the book, this is not sufficient to stabilize debt. We need both faster economic growth and a sensible set of fiscal reforms that complement each other, and if these are effectively implemented, we should be able to restore momentum of growth and stabilize the public finances. And that summarizes really the MTBPS story. So much of the discussion last week was about this graph, the latest debt to GDP projections. This does include all of these different shocks and fiscal measures I've just mentioned, and as we can see, the debt doesn't stabilize as it had previously done in the 2019 budget, and a lot of the discussion was about how one goes about stabilizing the debt to GDP ratio over time, and that we will come to as well in a moment. The issue of the credibility of the forecasts came up again. We have, for the committee members that are new, this has been discussed in the past, and both in the February budget and last year's MTBPS, we presented fairly extensively on the work that has been done to determine the relative accuracy of Treasury versus other institutions, and in general, our forecasts are found to be on par or slightly better than other institutions. And if you look at the latest growth numbers, I think this is quite a useful table because it can give you a sense of what other well-respected forecasters think the GDP growth outlook will be for South Africa. So National Treasury is there at the top. Then we've got a series of other institutions and Reuters median and average, which is basically a reflection of what the market is anticipating. And you can see that the Treasury numbers are very much within the distribution of what other institutions and market players are anticipating. Now, on the tax numbers themselves, we actually haven't changed the way in which we calculate taxes. We published the entire model, as it were, on page 68 of the MTBPS. It shows all the tax bases and buoyancies. And broadly speaking, we assume most buoyancies to be one, which means there's a one-to-one relationship between the revenue collect and the rate of growth of the tax base. And we think those are credible. They're conservative but credible buoyancies. And if you look at those numbers, you'll see that the reason why taxes are down so much relative to the February estimate is because of the big downward revisions to the tax bases, particularly for the wage bill and household consumption. So all of those numbers are there, and we think a buoyancy of around one is credible. Now, obviously, this is much of the focus of MTBPS is on fiscal policy, which is to be expected and is correct, but we are arguing that we need a combination of growth measures and fiscal measures in order to right the public finances. This is a summary of some of the measures that have been outlined in the book. We're saying that there are some short-term reforms that can be implemented immediately, which don't require significant state resources, and I list some of them there. Support for tourism, cutting red tape in the small business sector, expanding telecom services, lowering the cost of business. And then, of course, in the discussion paper that was released by the Treasury recently, it goes into much greater detail about the kind of larger medium-term reforms that are required in transport, water, telecoms, and industrial and trade policy. So although much of the debate is on fiscal policy alone, it really does require a combination of growth reforms and fiscal measures. Now, the first question that came up a lot is whether or not our fiscal choices are the reason why the economy has slowed down over the past decade, and whether or not this has been an austere budget. If you look at where South Africa is relative to its peers, this is the change in our debt to GDP ratio over the past decade. And you can see that South Africa actually has added more debt as a share of GDP than most of its peers. It's towards the top end of the distribution. And in fact, there have been other countries that have reduced their debt over the same period. So our view is that fiscal policy has been fairly accommodative, that we've been running large deficits, and not only that, that we've had real growth in our non-interest spending budget over that period. So it's not an austerity budget. It's a budget over the past decade that has tried to balance these competing requirements, which is one, to support the economy, and two, to ensure that there is a sustainable medium to long-term outlook. And that is precisely the fine balancing act that government has tried to follow over the past decade. But it's not austerity, it's been growing spending in real terms, and it has been accommodating large deficits through increases in debt to GDP ratio. And this slide, I think, summarizes why we believe that there is a structural imbalance between revenue and expenditure. So the black line is revenue as a share of GDP, and the red line is expenditure as a share of GDP. Again, for the new committee members, I have shown this in the past, but I think it's very important to understand historically. In the mid-2000s, you can see the black line was actually above the red line. We were running small surpluses at that time because the economy was booming. The global economy was booming. It was part of the commodity super cycle. Our revenues were up, and at that stage, our expenditure was actually below what we were collecting. And then in around 2009-10, with the global financial crisis, the economy slowed down dramatically. At around the same time, that expenditure was starting to rise. And if you look into why expenditure rose so sharply, that red line going up, a lot of it was to do with increases in the wage bill and also expansion of the coverage of the social grant system. And then some of those other amounts in there include support for for the state-owned companies and in particular ESCOM. And you can see that in effect we have this persistent gap that has emerged between revenue and expenditure. And although some of this gap can be closed by raising potential GDP over time, we believe part of it has to come from fiscal measures, and that's why the MTBPS proposes such. As the fiscal framework stands now, and as the fiscal framework has done over the past decade or so, we have tried as far as possible to protect the frontline service delivery areas in a very constrained and difficult fiscal environment. But I think the major concern for us is that line at the top, which are debt service costs. In other words, the interest that we pay on what we're borrowing is now the fastest growing line item on this graph, growing at around 13%, 13.7% per annum over the next 3 years. And this is one of the costs of borrowing. Of course, borrowing can provide some short-term support to the economy, but it also has longer-term consequences that have to be managed and considered. So for us, that is one of the biggest arguments for stabilizing debt.
Can I suggest something, colleagues? What you are doing is you're giving us yet another overview of the budget under the MTBPS. There are specific proposals made by civil society. They come to Parliament. We are answerable to them.
Right.
This is unusual the way you're going about it. I don't know if colleagues, the majority can decide, sorry.
I'm afraid I don't agree. The gentleman is dealing very comprehensively with the stimulus.
Okay, let me finish.
Yeah,
can I finish? So what I'm saying is, we are answerable to civil society. This briefing can be given to us separately, really. Can I finish? You can have your say. No one will stop you. I have no authority to do
Thank
so.
Thank you, sir.
You've got half an hour, right? What you are doing is you're going into greater detail on what actually is in the MTBPS perspective for the budget. When are you going to come around to answer the specific concerns raised by people in civil society from your point of view so that they can reply so that we can focus on recommendations? I'm not saying you shouldn't do this. manage your time properly. Yes, Mr. Hiller.
Thank you, Chair. I would just say that the one of the frequently repeated themes in the presentations we received was that of the debate between a call for additional fiscal stimulus and the reality of the austerity budget that we face. The gentleman says it's not an austerity budget. But what he's doing in this is not just briefing us on the MTBPS, he's actually addressing very methodically and comprehensively that debate. And I'm quite appreciative of being able to continue that debate today. So I don't think that this is just a general briefing. I think he is answering the themes that were raised in those presentations.
In response to one of the many questions. But fine, if the majority want that, you decide. But then somebody has to answer civil society at some stage. So maybe you can meet them tomorrow morning, and you can give us a report. Maybe Mr. Hill Lewis will join your meeting. I've got constituency, political work, but constituency work, I can't make it. So those of you who can go this morning, tomorrow, you go. So we'll discuss a process. But we have to answer civil society. They are, it's a public hearing. It's a continuation of a public hearing. That's our primary concern. Often figures, with due respect to you, by Treasury and other departments, my experience, obfuscates. You're dealing very precisely, and it's a very competent, very, very good. I'm not questioning that, my friend. What I'm saying is, at what expense? People have flown in. Have you flown from Joburg, some of you, haven't you? Who's come from outside Cape Town? They have to have answers. What's your response to their concerns about the tobacco wars? So in short, fine, what is the meeting's view? Quickly, yes.
Yeah, no, thanks, Honorable Chair. No, I agree with you. Well, I think the information that we are given, I think, is quite valuable, and we appreciate it. However, I thought, like you were saying, that we would be answering specific questions that were raised by different stakeholders who came for public hearing. Well, for us, the information is good, but maybe we can deal with it on another day. Today, I thought we would specifically deal to say COSATU has raised this. What is the view of the Treasury on what COSATU has raised? Helen Suzman Foundation has raised this. What is the view of the Treasury on that? Because otherwise we will sit here for 3 hours, but then after that we find that those stakeholders who have made submission, they are not answered on the specific issues that they have raised.
The issues that we're raising, which I think is good. So in short, can we find the right balance? Can we leave it at that? Can we move on? We'll find the right balance. I can talk to you after this meeting. It's not been done like this before. But it's fine. It's a very good input. But then people must stay. I must leave. Because to get to Mzunduzi, I don't live in Eteguini. My last flight is at 18:15 today. There are only two flights. So I'm out of here at 12:30. Those of you who can stay, you can brief them. Mm-hmm. Okay? But I'm leaving here. I told the chair this. I'm out. 12:15 is the maximum. Right, go ahead. We'll give you an extra 5-10 minutes then. Is that okay, Chair? But we are finishing by 11:45. Good? Okay. It's a brilliant, actually it's an excellent input. Don't misunderstand me. But how's it helping us? We're going to write 3 lines in our recommendation. We need responses to people who are here. But go ahead.
Okay, thank you, Chair. So I do think we answer the main issues, and we are covering, as you mentioned, the tobacco industry input and so on.
Okay.
So I think we will get there. I'm just trying to explain our logic and the MTBP. But I will move through these more quickly. Then the MTBPS also talks about the structure of spending. So we have here a breakdown of every 1,000 rand spent by consolidated national provincial government. And you can see the numbers here that basically compensation of employees is by far the largest amount, followed by transfers to households, goods and services, and so on. And if you look at the growth rates of this economic classification, then it's basically financial support, financial payments, mostly in the form of support for state-owned companies, debt service costs, and wages that are the fastest growing areas of expenditure. So much of the debate was around the target and whether or not the government should have a more specific rule in place, fiscal rule in place. I mean, what we have proposed, in effect, is that we should be reaching a primary balance, in other words, bringing those two lines together by 2022-23, excluding the financial support for ESCOM, because we think that will be dealt with in a separate manner. Now, there were very specific proposals made, levels like we should have a 70% debt to GDP rule. Our view is that it's extremely difficult to implement a fiscal rule when there's great uncertainty about the economic environment. So, for example, if we had said that our debt limit is 60% of GDP, in line with what was published in February, in order to stay within a 60% debt to GDP limit, would have required massive cutbacks over time that we don't believe would have been credible or good for the economy or for service delivery. So we have to be very careful when putting forward a very specific target, because precisely because there's uncertainty about the growth numbers, there's uncertainty about the revenue numbers, and changes like GDP inflation or even the interest rate or your long-run exchange rate assumption can have big impacts on that. And maybe just to add one other thing, which is that even achieving a debt to GDP of 70%, which appeared in a couple of the inputs, would require quite large fiscal measures over the next 3 years. Okay, so one of the debates was whether we should increase spending, increase borrowing, or whether we should go for more fiscal consolidation. The issue is that on the one hand, if you go for more fiscal consolidation and you increase taxes and reduce social services, that has implications for the economy and for service delivery. And if you go for more borrowing, that also has implications for the economy, because it can push up interest rates, it can induce capital flight or ratings downgrades and so on. And so we are really in a dilemma. And what the MTBPS is proposing is a kind of middle way that focuses on growth reform and a 3 to 5 year plan to stabilize the debt to GDP ratio. Much of the discussion was also on the austerity versus stimulus balance. I think our views are that more borrowing does not necessarily translate into higher economic growth. And that there is an underlying structural issue that cannot be addressed by fiscal stimulus. So it is true that fiscal stimulus can support the economy in the short term, but it's very much dependent on the environment you're in and how economic actors respond. And that's why we say there that the quality of borrowing is what is critical. If you're borrowing for consumption as opposed to investment, it's harder to justify over time, and it has implications for intergenerational equity, and it has implications for growth. And in a sense, the investors that lend us money to borrow are going to be thinking about the implications of what we're spending our money on and whether we're able to spend it efficiently. So wider deficits don't mean necessarily faster growth. It depends on the context, and it depends on the fiscal market size that are assumed, and it depends on why government is borrowing this money. So from our view, again, we need a credible and sensible medium-term policy, both for growth and for the fiscus. And yes, spending reductions are likely to have a short-term effect, but what we must avoid at all costs is some kind of fiscal crisis, which would be profoundly negative. So why are we proposing the reductions as have been put forward now? The one is that we have in the past applied most of our reductions to goods and services and capital budgets. We don't think there's a lot of space left to reduce those budgets, whereas compensation relative to these have continued to grow over time. We hear the inputs that were given. There were several inputs that spoke about the fairness of any interventions to stabilize debt. And that's absolutely critical, we agree. So the fairness and impact on service delivery matter came up. And we agree that where possible, if you're going to be reducing the growth of the wage bill, this must be done in a fair way, which means relatively higher burden on higher income earners, and as far as possible, an application to the wider public sector. In other words, not just national and provincial government, but also public entities and state-owned companies. There was a lot of debate on whether or not tax revenue could be increased. Our view again is that taxes have been increased substantially over the past 5 or 6 years, and that there's very limited scope. But given the severity of the situation we find ourselves in, we have to consider that. We also think that there are options for improving non-tax revenue. So the MTBPS talks quite a lot in detail about interventions to try and improve the ability of the municipalities to collect revenue. And we think that a lot more can be done in to collect rather than necessarily to change the rate at which we are raising taxes. And lastly, to say that growth reforms are critical, but those are unlikely to raise potential GDP immediately. So one has to have a combination of a plan to raise potential GDP and to reduce the spending, growth of spending as it currently stands. There was a lot of debate about the public infrastructure spending outlook and a lot of concern about underspending. We agree with that concern. We think it is a major issue. I've included here the public infrastructure spending by the public sector, which includes state-owned companies, public entities, provinces, local government, and national. And we can see that over time, our infrastructure spending has been declining as a share of GDP. And the latest numbers, the provisional numbers, show that the public sector spent about 80% of its budget in the last fiscal year, with the largest underspending happening at local government and state-owned company sectors. So several questions were put forward about what is being done to try to intervene, to try to support public infrastructure spending, and I've put together from the MTBPS a list of some of the interventions. We have the budget facility for infrastructure, for example, which is an institutional process that tries to appraise and evaluate large infrastructure projects. The PICC, the DBSA, and other institutions have received some funding to assist with project prep. At the local level, there are various programs in place to improve the quality of infrastructure bids and implementation, technical assistance, and so on. And we are undertaking a local government grants review to try to reduce inefficiency and underspending by looking at the overall grant structure. And lastly, we are making progress with our efforts to bring private sector and DFI investment into the public infrastructure space. There is an infrastructure fund that has now been set up with the DBSA, and part of the reason for setting this up is precisely to improve the efficiency of spending and oversight of infrastructure projects. But it remains a major concern. Then there were several questions about ESCOM and the other state-owned companies, what exactly this is for, why these amounts, and so on. The total amounts now for ESCOM, $49 billion this year, $56 billion in 2021, and $33 billion in the year thereafter. Our view is that this was necessary to ensure that ESCOM was a going concern, to secure energy supply and to honor our contractual obligations. There was a concern that this money has been provisionally allocated to ESCOM without any other interventions. However, at the moment, as things stand now, we have, as government, we've placed independent experts into the utility itself to look at daily cash flow management and assess the implementation of operational efficiencies. And the National Treasury and the DPE are currently working with ESCOM to separate the entity into three functions. And a lot of the questions were around ESCOM's debt burden. Our view is that ESCOM's operational efficiencies and the unbundling process must begin first before we will consider other options to reduce costs and potentially move some of the debt off ESCOM's balance sheet and onto government. So unless we deal with the underlying operational issues, debt at ESCOM will continue to rise over time, and those must be addressed before any move to reduce their debt burden is undertaken. There is currently funding for SAA, the SABC, Denel, and SA Express in the current year. It amounts to about $10 billion. Over the medium term, we're very concerned because most of these state-owned companies are unlikely to generate sufficient cash flow. There is currently some funding available over the next 3 years for SAA, but that is to ensure that the government-guaranteed portion of SAA's debt is repaid. but clearly there are fundamental challenges in the space that will need to be addressed, otherwise additional pressure will be put onto the fiscus. There was a lot of discussion about improving efficiency and reducing waste in the private sector, in the public sector. We put together a list of some of the interventions. So we have very tight fiscal framework, but through reprioritization, the NPA in particular and the South African Revenue Service are going to be receiving some additional funding in the current year and over the next 3 years to combat corruption and improve revenue collection. But this will have to be supported by a series of other interventions and reforms. So we are proposing the merging and consolidation of some entities and regulatory agencies, the disposal of unused land and other assets, initiating work to limit claims against the state, including through a review of the medico-legal claims, implement recommendations from expenditure reviews to identify cost savings, manage the benefits received by political office bearers through reforms to the ministerial handbook. This was also a topic that came up in discussion, and review the existing procurement regulatory framework through the Public Procurement Bill. And this forms part of a broader process to look again at the regulations and processes within government around procurement and whether these can be optimized at the time. And then lastly, there were several inputs on excise duty on tobacco, particularly arguing that there shouldn't be any additional increases. Our view is that certainly we can't commit to not increasing excise duties, but it's clear that greater enforcement is required to reduce illicit tobacco and improve tax collections. And some of these weaknesses were described in the final report of the Nugent Commission of Inquiry. So reforms are underway. The new SARS Commissioner is implementing these recommendations. It includes the reorganization and strengthening of the illicit economy unit. And SARS are also progressing towards a track and trace system to combat illicit tobacco and have placed officials in manufacturers to actively promote audits. And SARS will also provide greater detail to the committees in a dedicated session on this issue, scheduled for the 20th of November. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you very much. Over to anybody. Who's here from civil society quickly? Who are the people made submissions? I know Kosatu is here. The tobacco TISA is here. Who else is here? You are from?
I'm representing women from
Oh. Okay, so there's three of you. Right, fine. Okay, who wants to go first? Kosatu?
No.
Your responses?
We'll follow
where
up.
Are you?
We'll come later, Chair.
All right.
TISA?
Chair, thank you very much for the opportunity to make an input again very briefly. As I said on Wednesday, the view by National Treasury that enforcement is a big part of the solution is not wrong. I said that clearly to the committee. I explained to the committee that 31 billion cigarettes to National Treasury is smoked in this country. They collect taxes on only about 19 billion. That leaves a gap of 11 to 12 billion, costing the fiscus 8 to 10, even 11 billion. So, Chair, let me just, you know, the reality of the enforcement, as I said to the committee, and I need your guidance, because the reality is 20 million, more than 20 million rand a day is leaked from Treasury. 20 million a day from tobacco companies operating within a radius of 60 kilometers from SARS. We know who they are. We know what the brands are. We've commissioned independent research. We've shared all of those in public to the committee and to SARS. So, Chair, the reality of the enforcement is the following. The track and trace system is all good and well. For very good reasons, the commissioner has postponed that tender now three times. It's now, the deadline is now the end of March next year. And let me just inform the committee that a successful track and trace system in a sophisticated market like the EU took 4 years to implement. We cannot wait for 4 years for a track and trace system to be implemented, leaking 20 million rand a day. Number two, the officials in factories was a proposal from our side. We pleaded with SARS to place officials in factories, and under Acting Commissioner Mark Kingan, he did it. There was an initial impact, but it's got no impact anymore. There was a slight increase in taxes, but those companies find ways to run rings around the SARS officials in factories. They need further training, further upskilling. We are leaking 20 million rand a day. We've made a further proposal for production counters on cigarette machines. We work on an honesty-based system where companies are required to declare their volumes on an honesty-based system to SARS and pay the excise. It doesn't work. You need technology, but that technology is going to take, counters on production machines will take another year to implement. So while we constantly use the argument that enforcement is the answer, how long can we wait for enforcement to be in place, leaking 20, 25 million rand a day? Last comment from my side, Chair, is enforcement is one part of stopping the bucket leaking 20 million rand a day. Excise is a large driver of price, as I explained to the committee. The government is the biggest shareholder in the tobacco industry and needs to look after that. And I've explained to the committee, if at worst we plead with Treasury just to stick to their own policy, which is a targeted incidence of 40% on all tobacco categories of the most popular price class in that category. On cigarettes, they have creeped 43.3%. So if our plea of an excise freeze or an excise reduction is not honored, then we plead for Treasury to stick to their own policy and stick to the 40% targeted incidence. We fully support the argument of enforcement, but it is going to take a long time for enforcement in this country to get in place. The committee needs to decide, can we allow to leak 20 to 25 million rand a day, which in our view is low-hanging fruit from companies well-known in this country. We do not have a big smuggling problem. The products do not come from abroad, a little bit, yes, but the biggest leak of the bucket is right here in our country, and we can assist by that from independent research that we have commissioned. I seek your guidance, Chair, because the arguments here to the Committee on Enforcement is true, but is not is only part of the solution. There are short-term solutions now, and the one is for Treasury to stick to their own policy. Thank you, Chair.
Okay, next is the lady from Women, yeah?
Any questions? I haven't got any questions to answer.
You said nothing about what they raised, which is money going from the fiscus to the Ingatam project, and there's no value for return.
No, I think that the submission was that it's not clear from the budget what is going to the project, and before, that's the first point, and the second point is that before money is spent, there needs to be a transparent and credible feasibility study. So those were preconditions for spending money. Those submissions remain. They haven't been addressed at all.
Yeah, but the thing is, I just crudely summarized it. The point basically is that you must remember also, and the chairs discussed this, and we have to alert new members. Every portfolio committee in this parliament, its work has financial implications. The portfolio committee, I mean the standing committee on finance, and we are not some super committee. We have no right to supplant the role of the respective committees. So this matter is not something we can decide on. We can merely refer with a strong recommendation that they have a hearing on this, and they invite Treasury and their relevant portfolio department. But in the meanwhile, Treasury should respond to their specific proposals. So you must do that today, please. Okay, over to Kosatu.
Thank you very much, Chair, and thank you for the presentation by government on this area. As Kosatu, we appreciate the responses that were given, but we stand by the details of our presentation that was done by Comrade Matthew Fox. We'd want to have an opportunity to consider in more detail what has been presented today and to make further submissions on that. But we would ask that the committee that is considering how we respond to the medium-term budget, that it looks at the proposals that we've made, that the kind of details that we require for the state-owned enterprises, for example, that be elaborated on, and that the matters related to the public service, even though government has clearly stated that that's going to be dealt with differently, that we maintain our stance that those issues and the expenditure patterns there be dealt with in the public service bargaining council. But Chair, with your permission, we'd want to make detailed responses on many of the areas that have come from Treasury today. Thank you.
I don't know if you hear, explain the process. The report has to be adopted on Tuesday, right? Because of this absurd situation that Parliament has to rise on the 6th of December, and you've got the Money Bills Act provisions, and you've got an NCOP that sits there that must approve, otherwise it's kind of a budget. So, you know, this is par for the course, and you're so good at this sort of thing. Tony, how long is it going to take you? So why can't you submit that by noon tomorrow to the committee secretary so they can incorporate? Remember, you must summarize your section. The submission that Matthew, by the way, Ned Lackey explained, right? That's why he's not here. So aren't you going to wait for the reply? No, they're going to reply. They said nothing about Inga. Is that right? You're going to reply, Treasury? Yeah, you know, you come here to hear a reply. Yeah. So you must get your reply. That's why you're here. Okay, so basically, what we're saying is, Tony, can't you submit it by noon tomorrow? The committee secretaries, please, and then feed it into the team that's putting together the recommendation. Okay?
We'll certainly do that.
We won't interfere with your thing. We might reduce it if it's too long. A page, maybe. No more.
All right.
Thank you. Okay. Anybody else from the civil side? No, right. Questions, comments to both the input? Or Treasury, reply quickly to the outstanding questions, and then we will, open up the debate. Right. Over to you, Treasury. Go ahead.
So I think the question is there funding in the departmental budgets for the Inga Dam project? And the answer is there is not. The main point I'm trying to get across, although it was a bit rushed towards the end, is precisely that we're trying to strengthen the processes whereby these large infrastructure projects are considered. So from the submission on Wednesday, it was clear that there's concern that there are certain projects going ahead that perhaps haven't been considered. This project has not got any funding in the baseline, and I want to be clear that we are actually seeing an improvement in the quality of projects, and we are precisely tightening up on these large infrastructure project bids because we are also concerned about the implications of wastage and underspending in the infrastructure sector. So. The BFI will consider it if anything comes through. There is nothing in the baseline, and we are putting a lot of energy into ensuring that we have the technical capacity to understand and engage with very large and very complex projects of this nature. Anything else?
Yes. You need to respond to what they said. You will hear how they respond.
Okay, so, the major issue is around the public service wage bill. We've heard their comments. Our view is that government still will have to engage with Kasati on this matter, and certainly we take into consideration this very specific comment about the concerns about the distributional impacts of it. I tried to explain that in the presentation, that we all consider the distributional impacts of whatever we propose, and I know that Kasati feels strongly that whatever is applied to the public service at the very least should apply to the other parts of the public sector, which is what I stated as well in the presentation. So unless there are other specific elements that we can discuss with them, we've heard their comments, we're taking them on board, and we are in agreement that whatever is implemented that will have to apply also to state-owned companies and public entities. On the 43 versus 40%, I mean, that's an issue that the tax team will have to take into consideration. We hear the proposal and we'll consider it. Tax proposals are obviously not put into the MTBPS, so we've now just opened up for public comment on potential changes to tax ahead of the February budget. You may have seen the tweet that went out this week. We are anticipating a large number of inputs, and certainly this can be included in that. And we hear you. We will consider it as part of the February discussions. Thanks.
All right. Who is the member?
Yes, Jordan.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Ryder.
Can I begin?
Yeah, sure.
Thank you for the presentation. I just want to go straight to the issue of the credibility of your forecast. You put up a graph where you compare your forecasts to other organizations, but obviously what you don't say is that just 7 months ago your forecast was triple what it now is. So it might be in line with other organizations now, much later on, but you don't explain how your forecast dropped by two-thirds, by 66% in just 7 months. That really does undermine the credibility of your forecasts. And so the question that I asked the other day was how Treasury would feel about a proposal that essentially forecasts be imposed upon it by other credible independent organizations like, for example, the SARB or perhaps the Parliamentary Budget Office. And I'd appreciate your view on that and perhaps your explanation as to why Treasury got it so wrong. Then you talk about some growth reforms. One of the very important ones is small-scale power generation. There are 17 applications outstanding on the Minister's desk, and I'd just like to ask what work Treasury is doing to to make that happen, to get it done. It's all well and good listing it in the presentation, but actually they just require a signature. And they could really alleviate our power concerns very quickly. Then I appreciated the work that you did and the comprehensiveness with which you dealt with the austerity stimulus question. And I think actually for differing reasons, both Treasury and the PBO have lost credibility on this question because not you personally, but Treasury has talked tough on the need to rein in expenditure, but actually expenditure continues to grow and the deficit continues to expand over the coming years. So you are quite right when you say it is not an austerity budget because real expenditure still grows. The problem is it grows in areas like bailouts and not in service delivery and infrastructure where it is where it's been cut. The PBO, on the other hand, says this is an austerity budget and actually what's needed is much more stimulus. And as I think you have shown today, that argument is fundamentally lacking in credibility given the reality of our fiscal situation. Then a question on infrastructure spending. Look, this is one stimulus that really could occur, is if we could ramp up infrastructure spending without the need to increase the expenditure framework, just spending existing budgets on infrastructure instead of consumption. Now, what work is Treasury doing to guard infrastructure spending at that provincial and local level? You've spoken about big projects, and of course those are important, but we know that they take years to plan and to execute. But there are hundreds, if not thousands, of smaller infrastructure projects which should be taking place on a daily basis around South Africa, which are simply not taking place. And that's because municipalities are cutting their capex budgets because for consumption spending, for compensation of employees mainly. So what work is Treasury doing to protect those probably far greater but more dispersed infrastructure budgets at the local and provincial level? And then finally, I think I'm near my 3 minutes now, if not over already. But
no, I've restricted you because only two people could have.
Okay, great. My final question is on the wage bill then.
You can have another 5 minutes. Nobody
I have only one more question. The wage bill, you've identified necessary cuts of around 150 billion, but by the sounds of things, you haven't even begun to speak to unions about this. The answer you just gave is that government will still need to engage with society on this. So I just don't see how it's credible or even remotely feasibly possible to do this ahead of February. to get an agreement with unions. So is that really a credible cut for, or a credible target for expenditure reduction, or is that just saber rattling? Thank you.
Okay, Dennis. You can have 30 minutes, Dennis.
Thank you very much, Chair. I'll use every second of it. Yeah. Jay, I'm feeling a little bit like I got dressed up for the matric dance and arrived and my date had let me down and there was no DJ playing any music, because I'm feeling a little bit like we haven't really gotten to the nub of the reason that we're here today. And I understand where the presentation came from, and it did touch on some of the key issues. I noted that a number of graphs were included that haven't been, the source hasn't been disclosed, and they were the same graphs that were presented to us the other day. So I'm wondering who stole whose graphs. But the issue is that I don't believe we've addressed many of the topics that were raised. Some of the broad themes have been addressed, but getting down to a lot of the other inputs, I feel that we haven't touched it. And you know, the Constitution provides for a couple of things, and I'm looking specifically at 216 of the Constitution, which talks about Treasury control, and then a little bit later 220, which talks about the FFC and the requirements of the FFC and their inputs. I don't believe the FFC's inputs have been addressed well at all. They had a long section about local government. Local government is very much highlighted at the moment. It hasn't been addressed by Treasury. We're all aware that the FFC also put together a submission for the next DORA. So the debate is still to be had. But it would have been positive, at least, to address some of those issues now already. This is the medium-term budget policy statement. The FFC and ARCHA did as well, although they didn't present to us, they sent their submission in, and both of them were strongly themed around local government and the impacts. We've had no input on that today. We've had limited input until the end when Mr. Stewart was pressed, inputs on the issues around the I hesitate to use the word populist, but the stance of COSATU saying that no retrenchments will take place, avoiding retrenchments at all costs, when all costs is not feasible any longer, and we need to start looking constructively at ways of reducing the wage bill. I think everyone is in agreement that the public sector wage bill is a part of the problem, at least. That hasn't been addressed either. The Budget Justice Coalition gave us specific departmental impacts. Those haven't been spoken to. You know, there were some scary numbers that were pushed through there of the impact on Home Affairs, for example. Hasn't been addressed at all. And I just feel that the civil society, the fact that some of them have come out today as well, people have taken time. The Fiscal Cliff Study Group, that was a comprehensive document put together. A lot of work went into it. It was submitted. And yet we haven't addressed the contents of that. The other one that I quite enjoyed was ShotSpotter that again, didn't present to us but sent in their submission. Their suggestions haven't been addressed by Treasury. The idea of taking on a more electronic and technology-based approach to control and so on. So I'm feeling a little bit, as I say, like I've been stood up, and maybe I would have had more effect had I gone to my constituency today, Chair.
Well, that's harsher than what I was saying. It's interesting. Okay, it's not going to help the staff to draft recommendations, but we will have to manage. Over to who's next? Absolutely nobody. Comrade Chair, I just want to say, yes, PBO?
I think it's worth replying to the comments about, on the one hand, we were seen as credible enough to have a macro model that imposes growth projections on the Treasury. On the other hand, our views were, we were seen as our credibility had been totally blown by Treasury's views. presented on whether we can move towards fiscal expansion. I think it's worth responding to that. Now, you know, the first point, I think a lot of what Treasury is saying is revolving about this notion of a fiscal crisis, and they refer to the fear of a fiscal crisis in this, and it's not ever defined scientifically. And that within the literature is a huge point, and a huge point for discussion, and there's, in terms of levels, there's no agreement, and nobody actually pushes for a level, even including Treasury. But to keep raising that as a bogey, and then to say, so in the slide 14, they say spending reductions may have short-term harmful effects on growth, which is what we're also saying, but the implications of a fiscal crisis would be profoundly negative. And that's not quantified, and the idea of a fiscal crisis is not defined. And I think also to keep pushing as like the national treasury that's going to the markets, talking to the credit rating agencies, to keep raising the fear of a crisis when it's undefined and not quantified, I believe is really dangerous for the economy and may actually be something that then pushes further reduction in ratings and interest rates rather than other things. I'd like to refer to slide 13. I don't know if you can put that up, please, Stuart. Now, on the left side, it shows that the more fiscal consolidation leads to lower growth, right? And as I was saying, the idea of a crisis then is the pivot. On the right side, it shows how more borrowing leads to lower growth. Now, those steps, or the text next to the green arrow, that may not be meant to be precise, it may be indicative, but I think we really need to question that. One is, you know, it will lead to rising debt, but I think, you know, the rating downgrade, to me, seems almost inevitable. If it's not about low growth or ISCOM, it's going to be about rising inequality and rising unemployment. Something's going to push us over that edge, which is sort of just teetering and we're waiting. The issue of capital flight, if we're concerned with capital flight, then we need to put in capital management measures, which Argentina has done now with their most recent crisis. It's something, in fact, the Treasury documents talk about further liberalization of exchange controls. And we need to really think about that. And everybody, including the IMF, is saying that in certain situations, that certain kinds of capital management techniques, exchange controls, other things are justified. And so if we're worried about money leaving the country, and this also then applies to the left side of the chart, we're talking about falling taxpayer morality. I mean, this is linked to buoyancy. If we're worried about that, we actually need to then think about, can we slow down the movement of money out of the country? I mean, every newspaper, Business Insider, all these things are talking to people about how they can move their money outside of South Africa at the moment. And I think it's time to really think about that. And not to say use that then as a fear for not challenging low growth. The falling exchange rate, and then after that talking about lower private investment, in many countries a lower exchange rate may actually spur investment because it makes your exports cheaper, and a lot of what we talk about is growing our exports, but at least that's in the Treasury documents. But I won't go into that in more detail. So I think, you know, I don't agree with the Honourable Member saying that our credibility has been struck by this. In fact, over the last few days, I've spent a lot of time looking at revenue and expenditure numbers, and I can't go into the detail here. In fact, I need to do more work on it. But I've been looking at growth rates. I've been looking at the real GDP per capita growth rates. And the story becomes very different when you do different tweaking. And that's the thing about statistics and what you can do with statistics. And we need to decide on which ones are more credible. Just like when we talk about how much we're spending on social spending, on health, etc. I mean, I think when Treasury puts nominal numbers in, average nominal numbers, they actually need to also put in average real numbers per capita, so we can actually see how much more is being spent per person. And if you look at things like how much we're spending on welfare, you know, it could be less than 1%. And we've got huge backlogs. And so we need to, so when we're talking about then, I mean, they're using a specific technical definition of austerity. When we're talking about austerity, what kind of cuts are we talking about? So, sorry, I'm taking a long time, but I think...
No, actually, you know, I don't have a very good input, but I'm not sure. He's going to come back. You're going to come back. I think we need to put this on the agenda.
Yeah.
And I think Jordan provoked it, but good Jordan. It's good. You're right to do so.
And I'm hoping that we can convince all the parties.
You're going to SACP equalize.
Yeah. So, I actually saw that my colleague Dumasani wanted to say something, so maybe I should pause there.
Sorry, good morning, members. Good morning, colleagues. I just want to comment on the issue around the revenue options. I think there's been a lot of discussion around whether there's a space to raise more revenue or not. And I actually wanted to comment during the public hearing that I saw a colleague from Cyper, is it Cyper or Cyper, you know, raising concerns that there's no space to raise revenue, and that's, you know, we've reached a limit. I think the point, and I see it's here as well on slide 15, and I think it's been said also on the presentation, I think what would helpful for oversight for the Committee of Parliament would be to provide some evidence, a sense of what do you mean if say there's no space or there's revenue, because certainly there's been, you know, a lot of discussion to say, is there room to add other tax brackets, to increase tax brackets, or even to think about creativity around wealth, more wealth tax, what are some of the areas where you can get more revenue in that regard. But I think also there has been discussions when I look at, I've been reading a paper about the USA's tax deduction that took place in 2017, what has been the impact of it. And clearly, you know, there's some way of creativity to say, even if you don't tax more than the middle class or more than the poor, but probably there are areas where you can be creative there. And I think the idea that there's no space, it's not helpful because it shuts the discussion down. You know, we can't even discuss whether what room is there or what area, what innovative areas would come. But also, I think last year we asked a question around taxing on income from digital activities. I think currently we are taxing because of the consumption, you know, in that regard. But there haven't been much discussion in terms of the income coming from the digital economy activities or the transaction that takes place there. You know, for those businesses, what has been some thinking around that area? I know internationally there's been a lot of discussion to say, how do you get that at a multilateral level? You know, I know there's been discussion around OECD, even around UN, you know, some other bodies. But I think other countries are going unilaterally to try to think creatively, how do we get more revenue? Because as economies are now becoming more digital, it becomes quite, the tax base becomes even more thinner and thinner. So I think we haven't had a lot of discussions in that regard. Thanks, Jeff.
There's Zolani, there's, what's his name, Jordan, Skosana, and our friend from EFF. We don't know your name, sorry.
Thanks so much. My name is Rebecca Mushala. I'm the alternate member in this portfolio committee. Thank you.
Okay, in that order, please.
Thank you, Chairperson. So, very simple question from me, Chairperson. There were pensioners who came from Mugungundlo, Pietermaritzburg.
Yeah.
And they were asking for a pattern check. They are proposing a pattern check And then I think in our discussion we also raised the issue of perhaps looking at increasing that pension grant in or stipend into a living wage level, which we are really supportive of it. And we also spoke about the possibility perhaps of Treasury considering exempting the pensioners from paying that VAT. We would like some work to be done in this direction. Perhaps what Treasury can help us with is to first to calculate how much would it cost if we were to raise the pension grant into a living wage, which is about 2.5. And then secondly, the possibility of that, considering that 13 check as to what would be the cost to the national fiscus insofar as that is concerned. So very simple issue, but I think it also makes sense if we were to look into this issue of exempting them from paying the VAT. It wouldn't do a harm. It's something that I think we need to consider. Thank you, Chairperson.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter really.
Okay. I mean, this is a critical debate, and I really do hope that we can have more time for it.
Yeah.
But let me just say that I think we might be talking past each other a little bit, because fundamentally, you know, every budget is a trade-off. You've got finite resources, and while it might be possible to squeeze a little bit of more blood from the tax stone, very little, not much at all. South African households are under serious financial stress. And so what you've got to do is you've got to work within your means. Now, if you're spending more and more of your means on paying off the credit card, so to speak, you've got less money for food and light and water. Now, sir, if I ran my household like that, I'd be under debt review. Yeah, but there's not an infinite capacity to just borrow and borrow and borrow. And I just really do think that it does undermine credibility to make that argument. That's not to say that you aren't credible on other questions. It's not a zero-sum game of credibility. Also, by the way, there's an internal contradiction in your argument to say that you want more household consumption spending, but you want to tax people more as well. You know, tax reduces household consumption spending. So you know, that's an internal contradiction as well. Look, also, you know, I must say I'm not one to heap praise on Cassata for their, you know, economic inputs usually. But Cassata's presentation was thoughtful, credible, and it said that we cannot afford to allow or to be nonchalant about the idea of a Moody's downgrade. Now, I must say, I find it quite staggering for you to say that the ratings downgrade is inevitable and that we must just operate as if it is going to happen and carry on spending. That's just not responsible economics and will make South Africans poorer. As will, I'm afraid, a VAT increase. You know, I really oppose that suggestion. That VAT, there's lots of evidence to show that the incidence of VAT falls mainly on the poor because they spend a greater proportion of their income on retail products, and I think that would be a very irresponsible thing to load up the poor to carry on bailing out SOEs. And this is the fundamental trade-off that we're not spending enough time discussing, and this is why I say, sir, that we might be talking past one another, because of course I think that every single person in this room would love to spend more money on social services. I certainly know I would. I would love to do that, but as long as we're spending 59 billion rand this year and 33 billion rand next year on Eskom alone, not to speak of those other ball and chains around our collective national neck, then we cannot even dream of increasing social spending in the way that we would all love to do. So this is the trade-off that I'm talking about and the hard choices that we have to discuss.
Yeah.
No, thanks, Honorable Chair. Yeah, I heard the presenter there from National Treasury saying that the views in relation to taxes, I think, will be dealt with separately. said that I think there's a tweet that is out which seek to get inputs and submissions in relation to the issue of taxes. I don't know. Just want to find out what is the reason for that. Why are you? Do you want us to deal with that issue separately? Because I think it's part of the package. And taking into consideration that some submission, I think they were raising views, different views in relation to tax. For instance, if you have seen the submission from SAICA, South African Institute of Chartered Accountants, they are saying that because of the consistent and significant increases in various taxes in the past few years, increasing tax now might have in fact a negative impact. It might in fact yield contrary results than what you are looking for. Instead of generating more revenue, you might even get less revenue. In fact, they are proposing that instead of increasing taxes, you better reduce them in order to get more revenue. I don't know if you have looked at that particular submission. If you have looked at it, can you perhaps express your views on it? Secondly, I see on slide 17 where we are talking about the reviewal of local government grants. Can you perhaps just elaborate what does this reviewal of the local government grants entail? Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Thanks.
Comrade Rebecca.
No. Thanks so much, Chair. When looking at the interventions to stabilize Eskom and other state-owned enterprises, I don't see the issue of leadership. Because at the moment, when if we look at Eskom, Eskom is facing a very serious challenge in terms of leadership. I don't think the likes of Jabu Magusa is going to assist Eskom going forward. The other issue I want to touch on is the issue of unbundling of Eskom. That thing is not going to assist Eskom going forward. We need to, more especially now, in this financial crisis. We are in a financial crisis, and the government just decided that now we're going to unbundle Eskom, and that we think that will stabilize Eskom. No, it's not going to happen. So let's think of other means of how we can assist Eskom. The issue of the money that we keep pumping in Eskom is also not assisting Eskom. In 2015, the previous Minister Nhlanhla Nene, he pumped close to 26 billion into Eskom, and he said it will never happen again. That will stabilize Eskom. But still, every year, every financial year, we are pumping more money in Eskom, thinking that Eskom will be stabilized. I think we need to sit down and have a clear view or a clear discussion of how can we solve these issues that are facing our state-owned enterprises and Eskom. Thank you. Mm.
Okay. You want to say something, my friend? Yes.
I just wanted to respond to the Treasury response that said that there was no allocation for the Inga Dam because in the medium-term budget policy statement there is quite a significant allocation for foreign government and international organizations under clean energy. So I would just like to have some clarity about, well, what is that allocation for if it's not for the development of the Inga Dam?
Right, okay. Kuricha, you want to
thank you, Chair, colleagues, Treasury, and stakeholders. I think, Chair, it would be important that in compiling our report, we take note of what has been raised by the PBO, FFC, and the research unit. They are very, very critical issues which are scientific and in their noting. Like the question of the wage bill, they ask us, it's PBO. There's a section on the overview of state employees.
that if there is a high wage bill, at which level? Is this at the coal phase where the service delivered? Do you want to take out nurses, teachers? Then what is it that you want to achieve? Or is it at head office? So we should not talk in general terms, because it's of no use. People are used to this language. That's why unions get angry that you want to take out, retrench people for what? So let it be scientifically calculated that the high wage bill is at this level. SOEs, there they regulate their own remuneration, unlike in the departments where a public service department is quite very strict. But there's no public service. Every entity has got its remuneration structure. It's a problem. So you can't only talk the wage bill when you talk public service, and you don't talk the wage bill when you don't talk about the SOE. Because CEOs, general managers, and 5 million. 5 million, here are the SOEs which are collapsing. How do we match these huge salaries that general managers, CEOs, and directors are earning in SOEs in relation to the efficiency of that SOE? We must ask critical questions, because the public is not happy about the bailouts. For this bailout is not money from somewhere. It comes from taxes. And you talk about increasing taxes. As for now, the personal income tax is the highest contributor of revenue. And as it is acknowledged in one of the documents here, I'm not sure whether it's FFC or parliamentary, that the more you do that, yes, I think it's parliamentary research unit, that the anticipated increase of PIT, they are saying that households are already indebted, and this will negatively influence consumption and growth, is what is written in the research paper. So I'm saying, Chairperson, we have to be very critical in our thought on issues that have been raised by those who assist us, which is FFC, PBO, and our research unit. The issue of companies under declaring is very serious, because in our situation, companies do self-assessment and they declare to SARS that this is the gross that we have generated for this tax year, this is the net. Therefore, this is what we can pay for tax. And SARS take it as it is. And we know there's high level of under-declaration of tax by corporates. It is well known. It's not only the tobacco industry which is having issues. It cuts across the corporate sector. And we have to do something about it. The cheap and illegal imports is a problem. What the minister raised there, that you go to a shop and you don't even get a receipt, is all over. More especially on shops which are already owned by foreign nationals. Here are these people, South Africans, who are doing business legally,
it's very difficult to get a license to trade. Here somebody just comes and opens a corner shop, doesn't pay tax. They even write there that there's no, you, when you don't have to return goods, what is it? No refund. Yeah? There's a shop next to, in Laboria where I stay. There's no refund when you buy there. I can go and show you. They tell you there's no refund. You just pay and then they give you change. No receipt, which is even generated by the cash register. And all these businesses are mushrooming all over South Africa. People come and trade illegally. How are you going to raise tax from those? And you tax those who are operating legally. Hence they complain. And they are competing against those who are trading illegally with cheap imports. So we have to deal with fundamental issues when it comes to tax matters. And not just gloss over them. And go deep and make a serious statement about those who are trading illegally. The other time I met Chairperson, people coming from the concrete industry, they are complaining that there's 1 million, how do we measure cement? It's not cage. Yes, there are 1 million tons of cement that enters this country. Part of it is illegal and very cheap. They have set up plants. Setting up a cement plant is very, very expensive. Very expensive. Cement comes from all over, Vietnam, China. They mention those countries. When they land here, the pricing gives a problem to those who are operating legally in the country. They came to see me and said, "What? How do we deal with this matter?" So there are issues that we have to deal with, Chairperson. We should also factor in the report of the Auditor General, Chairperson. Yes. The Auditor General has gone in detail in identifying wastage, irregular expenditure, fraudulent expenditure. What's the other one?
Irregular.
And yes, and unauthorized. Lots of money going down the drain because of that. And that the report is there on local government, department, and SOEs. And if you calculate the money that goes down the drain through wasteful, irregular, unauthorized, you talk billions of rand. And what are we doing about that? So there's money in circulation in South Africa, wherein if there was proper regulation and law enforcement, SARS was going to generate lots of money. And there has to be something that is done about that. And we're going to face another problem of contingent liabilities. The problem of RAF and this other, they call it medical lawsuits, are going to create a problem. By calculations, not so long, it will be almost a trillion. Medico and RAF. Where are you going to get that money in the light of the fiscal challenges that we are having? And we were saying that the sooner we expedite the other act, road accident, something, benefit, I forgot what they call it. Yes, so I was saying, Chairperson, let's, in our report to Parliament, note the issues raised by PBO, which are very critical here, the research unit, FFC, and Auditor General, to say these are the problems, first with government. SOEs, everybody's complaining about them, and they are going nowhere. So we have to do that. Then when we recommend, Junkies raised the issue of Uber, Google, and others, who are generating billions. When I was in transport, for instance, taxi people marched to the Department of Transport. And so you are very hard on us who have got legal permit. But here's the Uber, which is operating without a permit and generating a lot of money. And because of the sophisticated technology coming from America, they are outdoing us. And nobody is doing anything about that. This issue of forced industrialization and people going into that sector to do business, which becomes very difficult for SARS to regulate, is a matter that we have to raise, and SARS give us an explanation, as to, because there are cases that can be cited of those who are doing that, including, for instance, what is this thing of shopping over through the computer
online.
And
digital
online? You see, when you are going to the airport on the R21, those warehouses are booming because of the online shopping, and it's killing big retailers. Starterford is no longer here. Edgar's is struggling to survive, and many more are going to collapse. The next thing you will see, malls empty, and we're going to have a problem. Already we have got big companies that have collapsed, Basel Reed, Group 5, and so we can't keep quiet when you have got such big companies collapsing in front of you. They might have their own issues. I hope Public Works Portfolio Committee will have to look at that matter, because they employ thousands of people, and what is it that can be done? Because when in America there was a problem of Lehman Brothers and others, the government intervened in that sector and stabilized. So I was saying, Chairperson, it will be important on the noting part that we go into detail to inform the public and our colleagues in regard to the scientific information that is in the two research documents. Then we make recommendations out of that. Thanks very much.
One is, look, I don't think, well, my reading at least of the situation here is that nobody's blaming you personally, presumably, not for a fact. So don't take it personal. Right? You're representing National Treasury. And you did a very good job, but not the job that we wanted. And we need to discuss the chairs to write to the National Treasury what we want. Maybe we weren't clear, maybe it's because, you know, previously other people did it, but strictly we asked for the DG to be here. Let me remind you, Chairperson, this is a budget issue. We finally gave in when they persuaded us that it's a very difficult time, and we understand. So really there should be a DDG here. But that's something we can discuss. So no one's questioning your technical competence. It's a very good, erudite input, Ian. That's not the issue. But it's not, as Dennis says, what we came for. To the extent you did it, what you've done is you sparked a debate. And exactly what I understood had happened. There's a lot that Saraj says that some of us will agree with, actually. But we think Saraj also goes too far. Well, I think. I can't speak for anybody else. Who am I speaking for? Skozani hasn't given me a mandate. I'm speaking for myself, right? I think Saraj also goes a bit overboard. Now, the question I want to raise is, firstly, Comrade Chair, it's really something that the NA committee must think about. We can't prescribe. At some stage, before the budget, I think you must come back with that input. And Saraj, you must critique it. And, you know, we can have a debate for at least 2 hours on that. That's quite crucial. We can't leave it hanging in the air. Because, Comrade Chair, we ourselves in the ANC study group need to look at these issues of austerity and, you know, stimulus and so on. It's a big issue now, given where we are. So I would suggest we think about that. But that's for you, Comrade Chair, to take the lead on. It's merely a proposal. Secondly, I think, you know, your answers about economic forecasts are not credible.
They're just not. It's gone on for too long, Comrade. Too long. We've been raising this before, and you really you have to jack your act up. Now, Jordan suggests that the FFC, I don't know, Frank was advised, Jordan, I don't think the PBO can do that. It's not its role. It's not an arm of the executive. Strictly speaking, it's not an arm of Parliament either. It's an independent institution that advises Parliament. It can make no decisions for us. Ultimately, we take that. It gives us options at most. So I don't think, Jordan, they can do that. But I can understand your frustration. I don't think they are party political issues all the time. You may not want to believe this, but I'm not as combative as maybe, you know, well, I am, but I mean, what is a politician meant to do when you guys talk such nonsense most of the time, DA, and not least EFF? But leave that aside. I would draw that. Right.
You can we move on? Sweetness in life.
No, I'm not that either. But what I'm saying is, I do feel, Comrade Che, you know what, we must try to depoliticize the situation now. We are one country, really. Right? And really, no matter who comes to power in the year 2060, Jordan, I can't see anything happening before then, the fact is we have to manage this economy. If tomorrow the DA or the EFF came to power, tell me something. How are you going to bring down the budget deficit overnight? You can't. If you nationalize the economy overnight, it will shoot up to 95%, right? So you yourself, if you came to power, my sister, you will be forced to deal with the same realities that what you call a neoliberal national treasury does, right? And the DA also. So there are sometimes we have to come together, and Jordan's right, and I agree 100% with him, except on the PBO story, that actually it's just not credible yet. It's gone now. You've lacked credibility, not you, Treasury. You have to jack your act up together. And I think the committee can't fold its arms and keep complaining and carping. We want action from you. The next time you go wrong, if you do, we must hold the minister here, himself. He must answer. So we're telling you, do it properly. It's long overdue. We've been raising this with you. Look at the previous reports, 3 years. We got tougher. Verbally, we said it from, I think, I don't know where's Dicolari, 2016 we raised it, I think, first. But we started putting our reports in this year. So, yes, it's not on. You have to accept, you have to be more modest and realistic of what's possible. Point one. Point two is that, excuse me, on the issue of PBO, Jordan, speak to Frank. I don't think that's doable. On the matter of FFC, again, I don't think that's doable, but maybe I'm wrong there. It can offer advice, but it can't be prescriptive on that. But that's a matter we can discuss offline, right? But why don't you do consult more with others? I know you sit and you have a team, you include SARS and projections and so on. Maybe you should explain to this committee as you once did 2 years ago, so the new committee when you come next time, how you actually decide who you draw on for support. How independent is some of the inputs? Are you using some of our top academics? Right? Ultimately, you decide. The executive decides. But are you, I think Jordan's point is correct. Are you consulting enough to arrive at a realistic forecast? You've learned the lesson now. For 5 years, you've got it dismally wrong. Right? So I agree with Jordan, Comrade Che. He's right, for one, you know, except about a technical issue of PBO. So the next thing then is your reply on INGA. Maybe I'm getting old and doddery, but I thought there was a thing in the media about a month ago about the amount of money South Africa has put into INGA. Where did that money come from? How much has been spent? I thought I saw something in the media in the last month when the INGA dams something about China having retreated, the companies having come to a standstill because of some disagreement. It was in the media, I thought, and I thought it was a figure from South Africa, right? I think, Comrade Chair, in recommendations, we have no choice, my sister. We'll have to go to that committee. This presumably even falls under energy, right? Because it's about electricity, am I right? So therefore, it's the Energy and Minerals Committee, as it's now called, right? And I think we should refer this matter to them, request that they meet with Women and International Rivers, and that they consider this matter, and they must bring in Treasury and discuss. That's not really our, otherwise we'll take over the job of energy, right? It's a policy matter and a related financial matter. Then there are some questions raised here. You see, here again, the chairperson will say, oh, Eunice, don't be so technical. Don't be like a bureaucrat. There's a subtext of what he says. But the fact is, we're raising some issues that don't belong here. They belong to appropriation. So I think it's unfair to expect Ian to reply to them. So Some of the policy issues belong to other departments, not Treasury. Some of it actually belongs to the other bill. So on local government, strictly speaking, the public sector wage bill, those are appropriation matters, and they should really be dealt with when we start looking. That's where we come in more, the NCOP, Dennis. That local government falls more like in a way when it comes to budget issues under us. So when Dick Lady comes with all the stuff in 2 weeks' time, that's where we tackle things. How much of money given to each sphere, how is it being spent, and so on. But Dennis, you know what, it took me 2 years to understand this difficult Money Bills Act. Okay? So, you know, it's a learning curve. But he's correct to raise those issues, but you are correct not to respond to them. Yeah, you'll be responding to them in 2 weeks' time, on a Friday, I expect. Then the issue of Siraj and yourself and Jordan, it's a very good debate. It's a debate we need to have. I've suggested how we do it. Then on the issue of TISA, now, I think, you know what, it's not about, as the chairperson said, it's about illicit financial flows, and it is despairing and disappointing that nothing has been said about illicit financial flows. Now, I know it didn't come up. I know that the NA committee, every quarter, when you get SARS and National Treasury before you, they report to you on progress in implementing the campaign against illicit financial flows. We also slid in towards, I think, after you came with some TISA, that input must include also illicit tobacco. So every quarter they are reporting. Nothing stops TISA from sending the Cape Town representative to monitor. What the chair and I'm not sure I got this right, discussed for a moment, and he will speak for himself if I got it wrong, is that what is the harm in calling a meeting through your structures between SARS, yourselves, and all the relevant, not only TISA, whoever is relevant, the tobacco sector. Have a meeting very quickly. Let the chair speak for himself. And then come to some agreement. I mean, there are some things that the gentleman says I agree with. There are some things I think, you know, I agree with you, Treasury. So, but why can't we? It's $10 billion a year. That's maybe a modest estimate. It may even be an exaggerated. Who cares? Even if it's 1 cent that's going out, it's wrong. And the health hazards, if I understand this enough, the health hazards of smoking illicit tobacco is considerably greater. And you're talking to a non-smoker. And you know, you can work out my private views about smoking. But that's not the issue. It's a legal thing. Let's do it. And the illegal people will tackle. I agree completely with the co-chair. Remember also there are legitimate African farmers affected. The constituency, the ANC, presents itself as representing primarily the rural poor and so on, and the emerging farmers. They are all being sacrificed here also. So can we please get some consensus amongst you? You see, Comrade Chair, we don't have the technical expertise, nor the time or the space, to sit here and come with a strategy for you. It's not our job. Can't you all just do it, please? Can't you all meet more often? Can't you all report back to the NA chairperson every quarter at some stage? Let them decide. We don't want to prescribe to them. But hell, man, this thing mustn't drag on like this. There are some, you know, the easiest pickings on the tree? You can do some. What? Lowest hanging fruit, yeah. Okay. So on the matter of, since I'm on my feet, as it were, okay, let's leave it till what proposals go forward. What the chair is saying is that we have repeatedly said to Treasury, Comrade Chair, you'll be interested to know, the research office is supposed to send its submission to you. When you appear here, you're supposed to reply to each of its proposals because it's an independent research institute attached to Parliament, right? And we asked you to do that before. Ian, I'm not blaming you. It's a new era now. You haven't done that, right? So I think the chair is absolutely right. He picked it up instinctively. He wasn't familiar with the previous process, but you're right. That's what we did, right? And for those of you who are new, we do mention what each of the FFC says and so on. There were no specific responses to some of the things FFC said. You dealt with it when you dealt with the overview issues. So what I'm saying in short is, Ian, we can give more time. We could have gone to you to 45 minutes. But to expect to speak for more than 45 minutes is asking too much. The point is, there's better balance between the issues there. But the most important thing is people from civil society must be responded to. Thanks.
Okay, thanks, Chair. So let me respond. So I think a lot of the discussions, let me respond on the forecast matter, first of all. I mean, Chair, one of the questions is how could the number change so much in a year, right? And the big part of that was the first quarter shock. That was a contraction that was mostly driven by the electricity supply stoppages, and also much weaker than expected numbers from the services sector and other productive sectors. So I think the main point I'm trying to make is that if you were to go back to February and look at the Treasury forecast, you would find that similarly to now, they would be more or less in the middle of the distribution of what a lot of other entities and the private sector anticipated would happen. So I think your proposal of opening up the process and having a more of a discussion is a good one, and we take it on board. However, I have to insist that, you know, if you look at what's been going on over the past 10 years or so, the Treasury forecasts are on par with what other forecasters have been publishing. And so it's more about these massive and unexpected shocks to the economy that no one could have foreseen.
For so many years in a row.
Yes.
All right, I'm not an expert. I hear you, but you know, we're not talking just about this year. There are exceptional conditions this year. We're saying that every year since 2014, if I'm correct, you've got it wrong. So maybe all of you need to advance your methods. I mean, with artificial intelligence and robotics and so on, you can't tell me you can be so far off. With the uncertainties and volatilities of the economy, you can't tell me that you can get it so wrong. So we're not the experts here, you're the experts, and you're very good. I have the highest regard for them, let me tell you, as technical experts. The policy issues, well, I can defer. You're great, so just do it. You have the potential to do it. We are sending people to, now where are we sending people to? Mars, eh? And this fellow is taking, Branson's taking people now to the moon. No, I don't buy that. But hey, I'm not an expert. I just instinctively recoil from your argument. It's not about you, get the world's best experts.
Okay, thank you. So I also think that I think your comment is that, you know, let's be more explicit in our responses or what we are responding to, and obviously we were summarizing a lot of information here.
Not easy, but
of course the SAICA was effectively saying that we cannot raise taxes, that our levels of our taxation are already too high. And the comment about limited room is precisely where we stand. So we've raised PIT, we've raised VAT, and other taxes, including the fuel levy. So the opportunities for further increases are very limited. That doesn't mean that our previous increases haven't generated revenue, like the VAT increase. So it's not so much about being at the top of or beyond the top of the Laffer curve. It's just that precisely we're trying to balance this of closing the deficit without putting too much pressure on the economy, and those comments are well taken, and that is precisely why we have stated there's limited room, but we have to look at the options, because fiscal sustainability has to be our key priority, and that is precisely what the debate is about. How do you achieve that? Okay, there were comments from the fiscal cliff group, which again I think the presentation covered, which is the concern. Their definition of the fiscal cliff is one in which wages and debt service costs effectively have crowded out all other types of expenditure, and we pointed out again that debt service costs remain the fastest growing, and that wages are also one of the fastest growing areas of spending, which is precisely why we're stating again that we need to stabilize debt, bring it down, and we must reduce growth in the wage bill. So again, perhaps we should be more explicit and state that this is a response to all of these different inputs, and that's precisely why we put it in this way. Okay, there were a lot of questions on INGA. Again, I will just say there's nothing in the departmental baselines for that, and there is some money in the baseline for Energy Vote, International Energy Forum, and so on, International Renewable Energy Agency, but I'm happy to have that discussion as well after this. Yes.
We have given money already, haven't we?
No, there's nothing in the baseline.
No, I mean in the past. there was a figure mentioned that South Africa has put some money into Inga Dam and there hasn't been return for it. Is that not accurate? Does anybody remember seeing that in the newspaper? Maybe I got it wrong. All we want to know is, was there money given? Can you check that out and come back to us by noon tomorrow? Was there any money used by the national fiscus for the Inga Dam? If so, how much? That's all we need to know.
Okay.
Okay, can you check it out, please?
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, then a few questions on local government numbers around the grants and so on. I think one of the questions is how do you ensure that the grants that are there for infrastructure are not used for compensation, for example? And I think the other question was, what does it mean to review the grant system? Well, the simple answer is that the grants cannot be used for compensation by definition. They are conditional grants. So they are protected precisely because of the way in which the budget is structured. And to talk about the review is simply to say that we're looking at the number of grants and whether or not, in fact, amalgamating some of them might improve the efficiency of spending. Okay, there were a lot of questions about this trade-off and, you know, can Treasury talk about a fiscal crisis or not? And the point we wanted to make from the beginning, which again should come up more clearly here, is that a fiscal crisis, this isn't really a science, Chair. That's the issue. It's not really a science. And it's particularly difficult to say that any level of debt will get you into trouble. So the question is, how should you manage the fiscus? And our view is you have to limit the risks of something bad like that taking place. And how it would look can play out in different ways. It could be a major shock to the interest rates, to the exchange rate, to growth. It could be a large capital outflow. We cannot say with certainty when that will happen, but we have to put in place a plan to ensure that we limit the chances of that happening. And it's not just about fiscal sustainability in the sense of a gross level of debt. It's also about the quality of the spending. And over time, if you're not going to be reducing your debt, you're going to be spending more on debt service costs and less on your other areas of spending. And so to respond to the PBO, yes, we agree. This is not a straightforward matter. But it's clear to us that if we allow debt to rise over time, and the pressures on the budget to rise over time, it's going to be more and more difficult for us to respond, to change course, and it's going to be more difficult to protect these areas of spending that we all agree should be protected, like social spending. There was a question on social grants. I mean, we'd have to do a more in detail calculation, but the 13th social grant idea would cost about 10 billion rand. We estimate somewhere between 8 and 10 billion rand. And similarly, if you were to raise the old age grant to around 2,500, we think that would probably be about 5 billion or so per year. But these are obviously high-level numbers for the purposes of this discussion. The point is, again, that would require additional fiscal resources in a very tight fiscal environment. Yes,
Peter, before it's misunderstood in the media and so on, there is no ANC position on increasing the pensioners to a national minimum wage. There's no. We are exploring a discussion, that is all. It's a question asked by an individual, he has every right to ask it. But there is no ANC position on that matter. We have not discussed it. Until now, the committee's position is this is an appropriations matter. They must discuss it. But we have said that on the VAT, if I'm correct, where's the old guard? Esther, on the VAT, haven't we said that National Treasury, notice sometimes we propose and sometimes we ask National Treasury to consider, meaning it's not an instruction to them to do. It's a consideration matter. Have we not said in the past, Esther, that National Treasury should consider exempting pensioners from paying that VAT thing? Did we not say that? You can't remember. All right. I also asked yesterday, by the way, a simple thing like stuff from previous reports, if I can have it today so we can start working on the recommendation. So, as I understood it, that was our position.
that we ask Treasury to consider. So that's not a policy decision, whether it's feasible for them to be exempt. That was something we discussed before. It is merely a question which a person has a right to answer. It's not an ANC position. He has every right to ask it, though.
Thank you.
Can I just make some
point to National Treasury? The reason I'm saying this, Comrade Chair, is because when I communicate to you, Ian, and your friend next door to your colleague, we are not like naive populists. We are excruciatingly aware of how severely challenged the economy is. We are not like far from the DA in where we say things are. The difference between them and us is what proposals we have to incrementally address the issue. So we're not talking about spending recklessly. Do you understand, Treasury? So otherwise you're going to think we completely passed each other. We understand the situation. Thank you. So no one's saying, over tomorrow morning, increase the pensions, right? Because I don't know what sort of report back you're going to give, and I don't know how the media is going to cover it, but unless the co-chair can disagree with me, we're not saying, we don't want to see headlines tomorrow that ANC argues for pensions to be increased to national minimum wage by February next year. We're not saying that. What we each think on our own, that's a separate matter, right? But we have no mandate to come here and say that. In moral terms, can we repeat? In moral terms and in principle, and in terms, of course we agree with everything they said, but we're realistic, okay? Even if Tony took over tomorrow, Kosatu, what do you think he's going to do? Right? So, Tony, you don't need to reply.
Chair, so, and then part of the discussion was also around the Kosatu input, which I think I've spoken to already. And, Chair, the concern about reductions to the number of employees in the public service, there are really only two ways to reduce the wage bill, growth in the wage bill. One is through headcount, the other is through the average wage that is paid. We are arguing that, you know, if you look at international comparisons, in general, our headcount is not particularly out of line, but as a share of GDP, we are spending more than our emerging market peers on wages, and we think that's because of the very strong real growth in the average wage of civil servants over the past decade, which has increased the real wage by about 40%. So we absolutely we hear and take into consideration these comments about the fairness of any interventions, the implications that it should also apply to entities and state-owned companies. But we are also facing a very large budget deficit, so closing that deficit in a sensible way over a reasonable time frame, we think will require reducing the growth of the average wage over time, and that's why we're proposing what is in the MTBPS. I think that covers most of the chair, unless there's anything else you've got in mind. Yeah. Thank you.
Okay, we've got time, it's 10 past. We can finish by calling it 12 minutes sooner. So Jordan and then Peter.
You know, if I could just ask for very specific responses. My proposal was that a independent growth forecast essentially be imposed upon you by somebody, whether it's the PBO or SARB or Stats South Africa or the FFC, whatever, but someone more independent than yourselves, because I think that you have a bit of a... there's a problem with rose-tinted spectacles in the Treasury when it comes to growth forecasts. Then you did not answer about how you're going to protect infrastructure spending at the provincial and local level as a critical form of stimulus. And then the on average wage reductions, I mean, the proposal that we made was that you essentially look very carefully with, you know, you take a surgeon's scalpel to the highest echelons of the civil service where the average wages are the most bloated, and that you protect nurses, teachers, police officers, and so on. That would bring average wage down without impacting frontline service delivery staff. I'd just like your specific response on that.
Thank you.
Chair, thank you. I do not want to be disrespectful to the committee, but unfortunately I have to leave. I had to combine my day in Cape Town. I have to chair a board meeting. I would like to thank you for the opportunity. The response from Ian is that the tax committee will look at it. It's fairly vague, but I trust that your proposal of a meeting will take us forward. Once we get to February and there's another creep on their own policy, the horses have bolted. And then next year, this time, we sit here and we've lost a further 20 million rand a day, as you say. Doesn't matter what the figure is, Chair. I hope and trust that the committee in its oversight role will oversee and support this view that we support Treasury and SARS fully. I want to make that very clear. We can clear that with Edward Kiswetter and the way that we're supporting them in all their actions. The reality on the ground is enforcement will take a long time to get in place. In the meantime, stick to your own policy, Ian. That's what we're pleading for. You've creeped well over the 40%. That is a huge driver in making legal cigarettes even more expensive, and as the chair rightly says, flooding this market with cheap illegal cigarettes, which is compromising the health agenda, which is compromising farmers, which is compromising the full value chain in this country. So more than that, I can't say. If I can be of any further assistance, Chair, to the committee or anything, please let me know, but I very respectfully would like to thank you for the opportunity, and I wish you well in all the very important work that you do. Thank you, Chair.
Thanks, Chair. I don't want to beat the drum until we break it, but I just want to point out I disagree with you on the local government issues. I think that the submissions from the FFC and from OUTA both point to medium-term budget policy statement issues, announcement changes that were pertinent to this recent update, which have changed the local government allocations, as well as the policy issue around district-based models, which does have a financial impact. So whilst I know we're going to discuss this at length over the next few months between now and February, I would have liked Treasury to address it. Again, I'm not insisting on it, it's just it is an oversight in my view.
Can we just explain, you can speak to Frank, the MTBPS is fiscal framework, which is what we deal with in the finance committee, right? Remember, then it has the division of revenue and it has the appropriations, dealt with by the appropriations committee. So we are looking, our report is not an MTBPS report. It's a fiscal framework report. We're looking at two aspects, revised fiscal framework and the three-year fiscal framework. We're not looking at appropriations issues. But again, you know what? I chaired this committee, right? It took me 2 years to work that out. So Dennis, I'm not getting frustrated. I'm right here. I mean, Frank will correct me. Frank is nodding his head. This report is on the fiscal framework. It deals only with macroeconomic issues. That other report will deal with issues that you are raising, and they will have to reply. So I don't know, Ian, are you going to come back and reply to appropriations next Friday or the Friday after? Will it be you? Yeah, then you'll have to reply to. Can you note the questions? Can Esther and the team note the questions and remind them that they must deliver on the answers? So you'll get your answers. It can't go into this report, my friend. But they're correct, the questions you're raising. In fact, I also have issues about what you are saying, agreeing with you. So the next thing very quickly is, can we get quick replies to the issues raised, and then we must move on to the Helen Suzman Foundation letter. That's been distributed to everybody. Yeah, okay. Oh. Sorry? Okay, right. Go ahead, Ian.
Okay, thank you, Chair. So do we think an independent growth forecast imposed would make a difference? Just to be clear, the Treasury forecasts are on par with or better than the forecasts of similar institutions. So I don't believe it's about imposing an external number. It's about the errors in forecasting in general that we've seen globally from institutions, both international and local, overestimating how much GDP growth can be expected, both globally and in South Africa. And so I would argue rather that we should be looking at a more collaborative and open process rather than imposition of any numbers, because it's not clear to me that what has been presented is in any way less accurate than what we're seeing in the market. The protection of infrastructure spending question, I think refers also to the one of the proposals that was put forward in the hearings on a current capital split rule, in other words, protecting capital budgets and focusing on consumption. In principle, we exactly agree that most of the reductions must fall on consumption. That is precisely why we're focusing again on the wage bill. There are reductions on some of infrastructure grants and so on penciled into this MTBPS. The difficulty is that in a fiscal situation that we find ourselves, again, our primary goal must be fiscal sustainability, and so we're proposing that the reductions fall on all spheres of spending, but the vast majority on consumption spending, including the wage bill. The other concern that I put into the presentation that perhaps could come out again is that the quality and the rate of infrastructure spend is lower than we'd like. And so even in these reductions, what we try to do is to ensure that we're targeting areas where there's a history of underspending, as shown in this graph, and as far as possible to protect those areas of spending where infrastructure spending is keeping up with the allocations that have been given to it. So if you're in a situation where you need to close the deficit, you also have to look at areas of spending where money is underspent or not spent at the rate that we'd like to see, and you have to find ways to generate savings there. Yes, on the wage bill, as we said in the presentation, we hear clearly the proposals to ensure the fairness of whatever is proposed, to look at putting a greater share of the burden onto higher income earners, and protecting others as far as possible. We agree with that. However, again, if you need a very large wage adjustment, the vast majority of wages are paid in the national public service, in the public service at national provincial level, to civil servants below the senior management levels. So again, in designing the adjustment, it would be difficult to avoid reducing wage growth also for those below senior management level, and we'll have to find a way to ensure that there's fairness without compromising our fiscal objectives. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Ian. Now, over to colleagues. Just to explain, the chair's got this letter, I think, sometime late yesterday. We referred it to Frank Jenkins because it's really a legal matter. Frank, do you want to explain quickly to members what the issues are? And, you know, we asked you to think about how to respond to it and the committee to decide what to do. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Yeah, the critical issue in the letter is the accuracy of the forecasts, and therefore there's a question in the letter around the value of the committee, sorry that I'm smirking, but the value of the committee considering the MTBPS and then reporting on it. The assumption flowing from the letter is that should Parliament approve the MTBPS, the outer years, the three-year fiscal framework, should be binding then on the executive. So this flows through me from a different understanding to the Money Bills and Related Matters Act. Because in terms of that act, the MTBPS, as well as the PFMA, the Public Finance Management Act, the MTBPS is the midterm projections and forecasts. And the fact that they're not accurate, from Treasury's side, it's inherent in forecasts. From my side, who likes to spend outdoors, it's inherent in forecasting the weather. But the fact remains that, notwithstanding the inaccuracy of forecasts or the reason for the forecast being what they are, the Money Bills Related Matters Act sets out a procedure to amend money bills. And the MTBPS and the way of considering it is part of the Money Bills and and Related Matters Act. So the committees do not approve that part, the fiscal part, which the finance committees deal with. The committees do not approve the MTBPS in that sense. The committees make recommendations based on the MTBPS that we received. And the recommendations has been discussed in the last 2 days. The minister is then required to respond to these recommendations when the budget is introduced next year. And should those responses be inadequate in the view of the committees, then it certainly creates the foundation to make amendments to the fiscal framework, to the division of revenue, and to the appropriation bill, if the connection is established. So from that sense, one answer, one response to the letter is to say the reason why we are reporting on the MTBPS is because it's required in terms of the Act, the Money Bills Amendment Act. The second part, and it's also part of the MTBPS, but it's now fused a little bit, is the revised fiscal framework. Now, the revised fiscal framework must be approved by the two houses. And that then sets a kind of limit over which one cannot go when you're looking at the Division of Revenue Amendment Bill and then the Adjustments Appropriation Bill. So it creates that safeguard to make sure that we do not amend the money bills beyond what we've already adopted in the fiscal framework. But that binds Parliament in considering the Division of Revenue Amendment Bill and the Adjustments Appropriation, but it does not bind the executive, and that's what the letter suggests, that should we approve the MTBPS after the 3 years, which we do not do, as I said, or even when we approve the revised fiscal framework, that binds Parliament and not the executive. It binds us in considering further amendments to the money bills. So in my view, Chair, that is one, what public participation is for, to discuss these kind of issues, and that can be part of the letter. Two, the clarity that's necessary can be given in a response, as I gave now. And then third, the real value or the real reason behind the inaccuracy or the accuracy or the nature of the projections is also for the Minister of Finance to deal with. So that is why we have a meeting like this today, is for civil society to interact with the Ministry and for Parliament to facilitate that public participation. So that is certainly also part of the letter, the response. But Chair, I just want to add that there is a suggestion in the letter what the committee should put in its report, sort of giving guidance to the public out there what the MTBPS is about, and making a statement why we think it's effective or non-effective. Chair, although a committee can put in the report what it can, what it wants to, I would be very loath to go that way. And certainly for a person to suggest that or an institution, I find it a bit irregular. The reports of committees are regulated in general by the rules, standing rules of the NCOP and the National Assembly. And further details of what must be in a report of the committee is contained in the Money Bills and Related Matters Act. And the committee should stick with that, Chair. That's the mandate it has from the House. And maybe that sense of clarity, if I can put it in inverted commas, should also be in the response. Thanks, Chair.
Any comments from members? Yes, John.
Thank you, sir. I tend to agree with your view, but the one thing that does interest me from the letter is that government has tabled an MTBPS with a fiscal target that is not in any way reflected in the MTBPS. That is a strange, that does strike me as a strange and unprecedented situation. So is it not possible for the committee to express itself on that observation?
Thank you, Chair. And certainly if the committee would like to. And that is, if one considers this letter as a public submission, and then saying basically to the committee from the Ellen Sussman Foundation, we feel that there's this discrepancy or this irregularity or inconsistency in the MTBPS, and the National Treasury should respond to that, and the committee can consider these and make a recommendation in that regard. It is exactly the process we're busy with here, and that's my point.
Okay.
But I'm not shooting down the content of their points, just the format and how it came. And that this forum is not used for it. I'm not shooting it down. It's just we need to respond to say, well, this is what we are doing in it, because the tone of the letter seems to want to say to the committee, this is what you must do, this is how you need to consider it. And part of my work is to protect the committee and to keep it within the rules and the money bills and related matters. So therefore my view. Thank you, Chair.
Dennis? Okay, look, basically, I want you to make some observations, and Frank, you can help me because you did some work on this, right? To some extent, what might have prompted this, more I can see, is the minister saying he's not so sure what the value of the MTBPS is. In fact, he said, we've got this thing since 1997, it's time for a review. Having a review is no problem. And in fact, we did review it last year. Am I right, Frank? That's what we did. And we can review it further. But he seems to be edging towards saying he doesn't think there's a need for it. On that one, I can't see Parliament agreeing with him. I certainly can't see the ANC agreeing with him. And I don't think we should. I don't think we should. For the reasons you set out now. And how are you going to do the revised fiscal framework? I don't know to what extent, and I doubt it, that he has the support of the government to say that. It's never been raised in that way before. Nor the ANC. I doubt very much. To some extent, this letter is not really meant to be addressed to us. It's meant to be addressed to the minister to ask him, what did he mean? And maybe we should ask the minister what he meant. What we could perhaps do is refer this letter to the minister and ask him to answer. What did he mean? And on whose authority? It's personally, he's giving his personal view. He's the Minister of Finance, but I mean, you know, it does say it. This appears to be the current view of the minister. We can't speak for the minister. The Act, the Money Bills Act, doesn't belong to the executive. No bill does. That bill came from us, Comrade Chair. It's not for the minister to decide. He has to come here and give us an explanation instead of making an off-the-cuff remark in the media. I think that's partly what provokes it. You see, they're taking up a specific issue. Jordan's right about partly. Jordan, I think you're right. I must think about what you say. Jordan's right in a sense, but it's not something that requires a letter of this sort. And I don't think we should get embroiled in this, right? It's a very strange thing, frankly, for the Helen Suzman. I've never come across this before. We therefore request, though it's a request, your committee to either associate themselves with View 2 or explain to Parliament. That's your job, Jordan. That's my job. And you can hold us to account as you know, opposition and the EFF job. And to us, to them we can give an answer, the entire, what their views are and the reasons for them. An appropriate vehicle for clarification would be the reports of the committees to their respective houses. This is going quite far, actually. I agree with the lawyer. It's unprecedented. My own view is this matter could have been easily resolved by phoning us and we could have got Frank to speak to their lawyers. It's a legal interpretation, not a policy matter. It's not a party political matter. If we are wrong in terms of the law we pass, then we are errant, and we must do what the law says. We are parliamentarians, after all. Secondly, I think that, you know, you should perhaps convey to them that this committee encourages maximum public participation, as you might have noted, going beyond the confines, going beyond what the Constitution and the rules of Parliament require. This meeting is not necessary. We've introduced it as a committee, and very graciously the new committee has agreed, and I agree with them to agree. So I think we should make that clear. And frankly, there are so many pro-poor considerations that the Helen Suzman Foundation does some very good work could take up. I'm a bit puzzled, actually, why this letter comes. I'm a bit confused. I really am, actually. There are so many good things they do and could still do. It's very unclear why they're raising this. But Jordan's point, can, Frank, you apply your mind to what he's saying. Maybe we should put a sentence in the recommendations. Can the ESTA team and so on look at that? Can you give us one sentence on that? Just, you know, we'll tweak it and so on. The chairs will look at it. I think he may be right. The question is this, maybe Ian, you want to answer quickly. We need to round up. Is this MTBPS falling short of previous MTBPSs in providing targets? I think that's your point, John. Normally, they do this and they didn't do it this time. That's what you're saying.
Yeah.
Or you're asking if they normally do it.
No. I'm saying that they have made an explicit target verbally.
Yeah.
Which is not in any way married to what is actually in the MTBPS. And
why is that the case?
Why is that the case?
Okay, Ian, explain that, please.
Okay, so, I mean, the basic thing is that there's a part of the reductions that we believe are required to close the deficit, and those are in the numbers as they stand now, which have come out of the general budget processes. But we think that additional measures are required. So what you see there is basically the baseline, as things are, as they stand right now, given all the economic shocks, the changes to revenue, the changes to the growth outlook, and reductions of about 20 billion rand a year on goods and services and capital. And for us, the primary purpose of this document is to give the public and Parliament and other interested parties a view of what the state of the economy and the finances are right now. We're making a proposal of what we think needs to be achieved, but for us the credibility of the numbers are very important. That's why this discussion on the forecast is such an important one. And if we choose to not make additional fiscal adjustments or economic reforms, effectively this baseline is what you see here. And we think that reducing the growth of the wage bill is what's required, but that is a major political and social discussion that needs to happen, and not what we believe can go into hard numbers, because...
Can you write a small paragraph, about 3-4 lines, because it's important to you, and tell us what you said now. Can you put it in a pithy, say, 4-5 lines? But Jordan, can you write a sentence or two as well? Send it to the team and we'll look at it and see whether we strike a deal. Can we suggest that one of the recommendations, we note this letter and we refer it to the minister also to respond, but as far as the committee is concerned, it has to act within the existing PFMA and Money Bills Act. That's all we've got to say in our recommendation. We note the letter from Ellen Susan. Is that okay, Comrade Chair? There's nothing further we can do. It will be referred to the minister to respond, and you will be mandated, presumably Frank, to act on behalf of this committee, all the parties agree, and deal with the legal issues with them directly. Thank you. Sorry, Comrade Chair.
So we'll do that in writing, I hope.
Yeah.
Because Ellen Sussman, I think we accounted them. I mean, we are not voted by Ellen Sussman Foundation. To say, explain to us and reasons, I mean, I think they are going too far. We can't. I think let's just explain to them how the money bills provide for the process that we are embarking upon, and we say the minister can explain himself on the issues which they have raised above. But I think they are now giving themselves powers that they don't have. NGOs want to be like at the level of parliament and judiciary and executive. And I don't think this thing should be allowed, Chairperson. When NGOs now want to take over the responsibility of publicly elected bodies, no. Because you can see the next step, we'll get a letter that we're taking you to court. I'm telling you, there is a court application following this thing. You didn't respond to us as we have cited in paragraph so and so. Either they want to interdict the budget process. There's something fishy about this letter. There's something hidden which is still coming. And in our explanation, we don't have to go into town. We just have to explain the legal process of why we're embarking in what we're doing, and leave it there. Thanks.
Okay. So, frankly, I hand it over to you, and you can exchange them over the phone and so on. We trust you. You know this bill better than all of us. Yeah. Okay, done. Then on recommendations, colleagues, can I just suggest to some extent, Ian, you have helped us in this sense, that, you know, you itemized the three main themes, right, but where you were lacking it. So to some extent, can we ask the researchers to use this as a guide in formatting the recommendations, right? Okay, we'll be meeting with you for 5 minutes shortly. And then secondly, what else do people want to add? Quickly, what else do you want to add on issues, including issues that are there? Now you've picked up what the members feel, Esther and Tim, right? So you can add, is there any specific proposals members have got? All right, while you're thinking, can I make a few, right? One, can we say that on the economic forecast, we hear Treasury, John, can I try to persuade you offline? You see, you can't impose on a government, really. the sort of way, I know your frustration, I agree with you, there's no difference between us. I'm not convinced by National Treasury's reply, but you know what, you can't ask somebody else to do work of government. They must take into consideration. Can we find a wording, Esther, that says that the committee has repeatedly raised this issue, right? While recognizing the uncertainties and volatilities, and perhaps there's some substance to Treasury's think that they're not completely off-key, we think that Treasury needs to look fundamentally at how it does this process and draw on more experts. But finally, a decision has to be yours. It can't be imposed on you by anybody. I think FFC can't do it constitutionally. I may be wrong, and I don't think PBO. In fact, PBO, I'm quite convinced, Jordan, they can't do that. Check it out with one of your lawyers, right? Then the second issue, I think, on economic forecast, we have to be quite tough on them. More support for SARS, it's not enough what's being done. Then on SOEs, I think we've covered that ground a lot. On public infrastructure spending, that's where we need to go. We need to report regularly on that. I think quarterly reports on it, the budget facility process, this new thing and so on, we want to monitor it. On South African cars, we have no choice. Can we get a mandate to write again to the president? Look, that one I'm prepared to do because it's a legacy issue. But we'll just say the chairpersons will follow up on this and demand a reply before the budget in February. And I will ring them and I'll brief the chairperson all the time if you're agreeable. On the matter of INGA, we refer that to the relevant committee, and we've already said what has to be done, right? On the matter of illicit financial flows, I think that's a burning issue for us. We can say something. On the Helen Suzman Foundation, one or two lines, we have to note what they said. On the matter of pensioners, we refer that to the Appropriations Committee, and the extract we've got from previous years, can we put that in? Right, what the committee said previously, we reinforce that, which is more or less along the lines I think all of us agree. Morally, yes. Practically, it's a matter of trade-offs, right? On the matter of what were the other issues, comrades? Now, colleagues, what, Dennis, you want to raise something?
If I may, Chair, thank you. I think it's important again to acknowledge from the presentations that came out the comment from the FFC, and it was probed a little bit at the time, but I think that it needs to be dealt with perhaps to conclusion, if not to conclusion, to an acceptable level, where the FFC indicated that they're not really happy with Treasury's responses and attention to their recommendations over the years.
No.
I do believe that that needs to be detailed in the recommendation, the fact that there needs to be some sort of a coming together between the two entities. They both have constitutional obligations, both mandated through the Constitution. If we can just ask that or recommend that in future there's closer work that's done and more detailed responses and interaction.
Now, I have to be open and transparent. We've discussed this before. You see, my brother, FFC, my sister, is in the Constitution. Treasury has been, I'm not talking about you individuals, Treasury has been quite disdainful of FFC. I know some of the ministers personally. I won't repeat what they say, even though they're no more there. And we've told them, hey, you want FFC removed, go to the Parliament and take it out. But they're there for now, and as Parliament we have to protect them. Dennis, up the ball, I'll write to your party leader. Tell him to give you a performance bonus on that. That's a good one. He's a new member. He's coming to his own independent conclusion, which is why, yes, it has substance. See, when the new members say things that we've been saying for 5 years, unless they've been reading that stuff and repeating it, memorized it last night, but I don't think he did that. That's good. Good point. Yeah. For now, the FFC is here. Your minister doesn't like them? He must go to the Parliament and change it. Go to the Justice Committee. First, he must go to the ANC. And then the NEC member here will sort him out. Right. What else? Anything else? Gentlemen, friends, colleagues, comrades, compatriots? No. Right. Okay. That done. Can the team meet? Can you round up, comrades? Is there anything you want to say in conclusion? Yeah. Okay. All right. Can we meet with the team quickly? We'll send it to you by 2 o'clock on Monday. Thank you. In all languages.